Miguel Ricart was born in September of 1969 in Valencia, Spain. His mother would pass away when Miguel was just 3 years old, the victim of a seizure. Miguel's father, an alcoholic, would remain an abusive and domineering figure in Miguel's life over the next 15 years. At 16 years old, Miguel would drop out of school and begin working. Over the next few years, he would dabble in drugs such as marijuana and cocaine while working, although he never became addicted. He worked jobs here and there, such as working on a farm as a teenager, and later worked as a used car salesman in his early 20s. He lived with his girlfriend for a period of a few years, and at around the time she became pregnant with their first child, who would also be their only child, a baby girl, Miguel enlisted in the Spanish army, which took him to a southern port of Spain named Malaga. After this short stint in the army, Miguel returned home and, unfortunately, continued his delinquent lifestyle. He began dabbling in drugs once again, and he struggled to remain employed, which ultimately splintered his relationship with his girlfriend. The two split up, and Miguel moved in with a longtime friend of his, named Antonio. Antonio Angles, who was Miguel's occasional drug supplier and friend, was not a good influence on Miguel's life. The two began to engage in small, petty crimes, which ultimately put both of them on the radar of police. Miguel would have two brief and minor stints in Spanish jails in 1992, the first in August for illegal use of motor vehicles, and the second in December for almost the same thing, threats and illegal use of motor vehicles. Both jail stints lasted less than 3 weeks. Basically, Miguel Ricart was a thief who stole cars to supply his drug habits. Despite Antonio being in and out of prison in the early 1990s, Miguel Ricart was allowed to stay at Antonio's family's home, located in Catarroya. There, at the home, lived several of Antonio's family members, including his brother, Enrique. Within one calendar year, these three men would have their faces plastered all over Spanish media. Circumstances put them on the path of the investigation into who had killed three girls from Alcácer just months beforehand. Welcome to the Unresolved Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and this episode is part two of my look at the story that has dominated Spanish headlines for years, known forever as the murder of the Alcácer girls. As a note before I get started, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for listening. I know that it's not easy to sit through an hour of my voice, but I appreciate your efforts. If you'd like to support the podcast, please head to iTunes or your app of choice and leave a good review. And if you would like to support the podcast any further, earning access to some cool perks in the process, head to patreon.com/unresolvedpod. That's just unresolved pod. No spaces, dashes, none of that. While you're there, you could donate and you could begin getting early access to episodes, join an exclusive Facebook group to shoot the breeze with myself and others, get commercial-free episodes, and even vote for an upcoming episode. In fact, this story, that of the Alcácer girls, was actually the winner of one of these monthly polls. So, just saying that if you do go there, your voice will be heard. In the first part of the series, I introduced you to the area of Alcácer and the girls that would later become the victims. Tony Gomez Rodriguez, Desiree Hernandez Fulch, and Miriam Garcia Ibora. Again, I apologize for any botched pronunciations. I've been pretty much focusing solely on the story itself. In this episode, I will introduce you to the investigation that followed, which dived into the lives of three local men and would be criticized for decades afterwards for a countless number of mistakes and logical gaps. This is the continued story of the girls from Alcácer. In November of 1992, the disappearance of three girls had torn apart the area of Alcácer, Spain. They had set off from their small town to a neighboring municipality named Picassent on a Friday night. Their destination was a nightclub named Couleur, and eyewitnesses saw them just a few hundred feet away from their destination. One eyewitness, who gave her statement less than a week after the girls' disappearance, claimed to see the girls get into a white sedan that had multiple men inside. According to this eyewitness, there were anywhere between 3 and 5 men inside the sedan, which would have made the car incredibly cramped with the introduction of 3 teenage girls. Over the next 2.5 months, the local media would become engulfed by this disappearance. Government officials, such as the Interior Minister and even the President of Spain himself, Felipe González, became personally involved with the case, meeting with the parents and expressing his concerns. One of these parents, Miriam's father, named Fernando García, became the face of the search for the girls, spreading the word to any news organization that would listen. When the bodies of the 3 girls were discovered in January of 1993, Fernando was in London, meeting with a number of news agencies there. The bodies were discovered by 2 middle-aged beekeepers who happened upon them by chance. 2 of the girls had been decapitated, and their bodies were in various stages of decomposition. All of the girls had been bound, and the pit that they were discovered in contained various objects, such as a random assortment of clothing, bits of rope and paper, and what looked to be like random garbage. However, the excavation of the girls' bodies would be marred by incompetence and miscommunication. Only 1 photo was taken of the crime scene before the bodies were pulled out of the pit, and the various items found with them were spread out and photographed together. The scene wasn't walled off until hours later, when the task force in charge of the investigation, titled the UCO, finally arrived. By this point, irreparable damage had been done to the case itself, but that would not stop the police from arresting a suspect within the day, and using the bloodthirsty media to take advantage of the situation. The day was January 27th, 1993. Police had just discovered the location of the 3 girls' bodies. Tony, Desiree, and Miriam were found half-buried outside of a town named La Romana, an area that very few ventured. The officials at the crime scene took a single photo of the bodies as they were found, but very little can be distinguished other than mud and dirt. From there, they pulled the bodies out of the ground, finding that the bodies had been buried inside some kind of rug. It was a big patch of greenish carpeted material that had been permanently browned because of its inclusion to the dirt. Records would show that various members of the investigative force thought the rug was blue, but later photos show it to be green or brown depending on the light. There were various objects which were recovered at the scene. A large t-shirt, which officials believed may have belonged to one of the victims. Inside the t-shirt, which was a white shirt with a red logo on the front that was rolled up, officials found 2 stones, which they surprisingly just left behind at the scene. No mention of them can be found in any of the later reports. Also inside and around the pit were a torn corduroy jacket, 2 synthetic black fibers, a piece of paper with hard-to-read writing, 2 small pieces of wood found at the edge of the pit, a piece of sailing rope found roughly 10 feet away from the bodies, various hairs and bits of bone, including a finger and several recoverable vertebrae, a video game cartridge, blonde hair dye, random bits of what looked like garbage. At the bottom of the pit, police discovered what looked like a shell casing. Upon further inspection, it looked like it was a spent 9mm round of the GECO brand. This shell casing was found underneath the bodies, under a few centimeters of soil. However, the sad truth is that most of the evidence recovered at the scene was placed into plastic bags, where it would all sit for an indefinite amount of time. In some cases, hours, but in others, they would sit in those bags for days. To put this into perspective, George Shiro, a forensic scientist from the Louisiana State Police Crime Laboratory, states that under no circumstance is wet evidence supposed to remain in a paper or plastic bag for more than 2 hours. That's because when wet evidence is just sealed into a container, bacterial growth can begin and damage valuable evidence. This means that fungus and mold can begin to grow, which, as you may know, can permanently ruin any forensic testing. It was with this blatant disregard of the normal process that the bodies were exhumed, the evidence was collected, and the investigation began. But before the day was over, despite the lack of evidence, police would already have a suspect arrested. The 75 days since the disappearance of the three girls would see the area of Alcacer united in the effort to find them, and their faces were plastered on almost every single street corner. Due to this, police had become pressured to act fast. They had failed to find the girls for almost 3 months, and now that their bodies had been found, police were eager to get a jumpstart on suspects. As I have told you, investigators at the crime scene found several pieces of what you or I may consider garbage. A lot of it was erroneous stuff, junk that did not fit into the investigation at all. But in the area around the pit where the bodies of the three Alcacer girls were found, investigators found some pieces of paper. When they put these pieces of paper together, they discovered that they formed a pamphlet from a nearby hospital. The pamphlet came from the University Hospital of La Fe, located a couple of hours northeast in the county capital of Valencia. This packet of papers turned out to be an outpatient leaflet which had been written the year beforehand. Information showed that the packet belonged to an individual by the name of Enrique Angles, a man living in Valencia, and that he had been treated for some type of venereal disease in 1992. Multiple sources have stated differing diseases, so I'll refrain from naming just one. Anyhow, this Enrique Angles was the brother of Antonio Angles, the drug supplier and longtime friend of the man I introduced you to at the beginning of the episode, Miguel Ricard. Enrique Angles, the man named in the hospital documents, was not on the radar of police. They immediately believed that he may have been involved in the crime, but their focus fell upon Enrique's brother, Antonio, and their friend, Miguel. Antonio Angles was born in Brazil in 1966, although his actual date of birth differs depending on the publication. However, it seems like he was born in the latter half of either June or July. Antonio Angles was a member of a large family. His parents, Enrique Angles and Nuisa Martins, had a grand total of 9 kids. In 1968, just a year or two after the birth of Antonio, the family would move from Brazil to Spain. At this point in the early 1990s, Enrique Angles Sr. had been hospitalized due to cirrhosis of the liver. He was a rampant alcoholic whose abuse had caused irreparable harm to the entire family. The mother of the family, Nuisa Martins, was a victim in her own right. She had been trapped in a mostly loveless marriage with the father of her many kids, and she had been abused for a long period of time. Not only by her husband, Enrique, but even by her own children, Antonio among them. Nuisa had filed the equivalent of a restraining order against Antonio because of threats that he had levied against her. You see, Antonio Angles was no angel. Following in his father's footsteps, he had abused his family members and stolen things from them to support his own habits, which included drugs. Between 1985 and 1991, Antonio Angles would find himself in prison on 5 different occasions for a variety of crimes. The first two occurrences, one from April of 1985 and the next from January of 1987, involved receiving stolen property. In July of 1987, just months after his last bid, he found himself back in prison for drug trafficking. After this, it seems like Antonio's crimes continued to descend into aggressiveness. In June of 1988, he was arrested and convicted of robbery with intimidation, which I assume is similar to armed robbery. He was released a year or so later, and found himself back in prison in February of 1990 for multiple offenses, including resisting arrest and drug trafficking. I know what you're thinking at this point. Antonio Angles sounds like your typical run-of-the-mill shithead, but this is where his story starts to get a bit murky. By this point, in 1990, Antonio Angles seemed like a scumbag. But he would obtain a conviction in 1991 that put him into scary psychopath territory. And it all began with a bag of heroin. Apparently, a woman that he knew, named Nuria Pera, stole the bag of heroin that Antonio was planning to sell to some clients of his. She was a junkie, so she just used all of it. As punishment, Antonio took this young woman captive, so to speak. He grabbed her and took her back to his family's home, where his mother and several of his siblings still lived. He chained her to a pillar in one of the back rooms, where he proceeded to beat her for hours. She was chained to that pillar for around 25 hours, at which point the Civil Guard got involved. They had been contacted by one of Antonio's brothers, named Ricardo. Antonio was taken back in front of a judge, where he was convicted for over 6 years. Not only was he convicted on a kidnapping and imprisonment charge, but the police found drug paraphernalia in the house that belonged to Antonio. Apparently, out of the people in the home who faced charges similar to aiding and abetting, were not only Antonio's siblings, but also Miguel Ricard, his longtime friend. However, in the end, Antonio was the only one convicted of anything. Even Miguel Ricard, who at this point was another lowlife, avoided facing any charges. Surprisingly enough, though, Antonio would serve only 1 year of his prison sentence. This is not because he was paroled, but rather, he was willingly released by the prison staff on a 6-day permit. I'm not joking, either. On March 5th, 1992, less than a year after his conviction for kidnapping and torturing Nuria Pera, Antonio was granted nearly a week-long pass to enjoy a reprieve from prison life. This has become heavily scrutinized in the years since, especially when you consider that Antonio left prison on March 5th and simply never returned. When his 6-day pass was over, prison staff were left scratching their heads when this now-escaped fugitive didn't stroll back into his cell. And the worst part is that, due to someone's ineptitude, an arrest warrant was not issued for the arrest of Antonio Angles until September. September 10th, to be exact. That's over 6 months after he simply absconded from a half-decade of prison time. Now, I can't tell whether this is a systematic thing when it comes to Spanish institutions, but surely I'm not alone in thinking that this is slightly ridiculous. I mean, the 6-day pass I can understand, but waiting 6 months to report him missing, and finally getting an arrest warrant? Anyhow, it should come as no surprise to you that 2 months after the arrest warrant was signed for Antonio Angles, the girls from Alcácer went missing. This provided a perfect story for police, who seized the opportunity. Investigators focused in on the Angles family, who were living in a home off of the busy street of Cami Real, in Catarroya, Spain. Catarroya was just a short distance northeast of Alcácer, somewhat in between the town and the county capital of Valencia. At the home were several of Antonio's relatives, including his mother, Neusa, and his siblings, Enrique and Kelly. Enrique was the brother whose name was found on the hospital documents, who had been treated for VD the year beforehand. Also, there was their younger sister Kelly's boyfriend, who was arrested along with the two siblings. While the police were there, serving out a search warrant, the man who had become the lead suspect arrived. It was sometime between 7 and 8 o'clock in the evening when Miguel Ricard returned home with two of Antonio's brothers, named Mauricio and Ricardo. It is worth noting that upon seeing police at the home, Miguel did not run. He just continued inside with the Angles brothers, who were all then arrested and taken off to the nearby Civil Guard barracks for questioning. It was right around midnight that police finally got around to questioning Miguel, after speaking to some of the Angles family members first. Miguel Ricard was taken into a room with several men dressed in civilian clothing. He told them his basic information, such as his name, and the fact that he had spent the past winter in prison for stealing a car. Miguel told these investigators that he drove a white Opel Corsa, a car that loosely fit the description of the vehicle that the girls had disappeared in. From this point forward, the police began to zero in on him as a main suspect. Then, the police interrogating Miguel began to focus in on Antonio, Miguel's on-again and off-again drug supplier and friend. At this point, Miguel had been bouncing around between Antonio's family home and the home of his girlfriend Loli, so they assumed that he had some kind of relationship with the man. During this first bout of questioning, Miguel does not admit to seeing Antonio Angles at all in the preceding months. He says that the two men had been friends for over a decade, but that he didn't know where the other man was, and he had not seen him in quite some time. He did admit that Antonio was an aggressive man, and he may have had some mental issues that can make him a danger to others. He also stated that he was mostly friends with one of Antonio's brothers, named Enrique. Miguel emphasized the innocence of Enrique, stating that the younger man was harmless and could not hurt a fly. He refused to say the same thing about Antonio, basically admitting that the fugitive was capable of committing the crime. This interview was officially labeled as the voluntary statement made by Miguel Ricart. Despite being detained at the Angles home, he had not officially been arrested yet. That would happen just a few hours later, at 5 o'clock in the morning on January 28, 1993. Police utilized some inconsistencies in Miguel Ricart's voluntary statement as proof of his involvement in the crime. First of all, they believed that he had been privy to Antonio Angles' whereabouts in the preceding months. They did not buy that Miguel had not seen him in months, and had probable cause to question him further on that. They were also intrigued by some of his answers to his whereabouts on the night in question. When asked about where he had been on November 13th, 1992, Miguel kept stating that he had been in prison. Police knew that he had spent most of December in jail for vehicle theft, but they had no records of him being in prison on the Friday in which the girls went missing. A quick trip to the prison validated their suspicions. The prison guards could not find any records of Miguel being there when the girls disappeared, and without an alibi, that was good enough for the detectives. Along with the white Opel Corsa that Miguel drove, matching the description of the vehicle they had been searching for, they felt comfortable enough pressing him further for information about Antonio Angles and holding him as a suspect. At roughly 5:40 in the morning, Miguel Ricart was read his rights in a holding cell, and officially charged as an accomplice in the murders of Miriam Garcia Ibora, Desiree Hernandez Fulch, and Tony Gomez Rodriguez. On his arrest paperwork, he states that he does not want to testify, and he does not want a lawyer. Both of those would change within 24 hours. It is after this that Miguel Ricart's story completely changes, once he is officially interrogated by Civil Guard police as a suspect. At this point, the police were not aware of where the three Alcacer girls had been killed. They had been found in the mountainous region of La Romana, but the area was surprisingly light on any evidence of the murders. There was no blood or evidence around the crime scene indicating that they had been killed there. On January 28th, while Miguel Ricart was sitting in a holding cell, six doctors were preparing to begin the autopsies of the three victims. Led by doctors Fernando Averdo and Francisco Ross, the six were missing the leadership of the usual supervising medical examiner, who was on leave. Just a warning, this is where things may start to get a bit graphic. So if you've been listening to this podcast with children in the room, I don't know why, but it might be best to pause for later. The bodies of the three victims were examined in their order of discovery. The first body, that of Tony Gomez Rodriguez, was the first to be pulled from the pit. As such, she was the first to be examined by this team of doctors in Valencia. She was one of the two whose bodies were found without their head attached, leading early investigators to think that this might be due to decapitation. However, that has never been proven. Like the other victims, Tony had been bound with her arms behind her back. She had been the victim wearing the watch that the beekeepers in La Romana originally spotted, thus leading to the discovery of the bodies. These doctors discovered that her body showed signs of rape, but her hymen was still intact. If rape had occurred, it had likely been anally. These doctors quickly identified her cause of death as a gunshot wound to the skull. A few hours later, the doctors moved on to the second body. This was the body of Desiree Hernandez Fulch. She was also found with her arms bound behind her with black rope, and one of her arms was bent at a terribly unnatural angle. Her remains had been picked at by scavenging animals, but most of her clothing was surprisingly intact. Like the first victim, her head was also found detached from her body. However, she was found without socks, which even her family found as odd. She was still wearing all of her clothing, including shoes, but her socks had been removed. The thing about this cadaver that shocked everyone the most was the fact that one of Desiree's nipples had been removed, with what looked like a blunt prying object, aka pliers, I know that this is terrible to hear, but I'd feel worse not including it in this episode. The sad truth is that these kind of details matter. This act, presumably done by the killer, or killers, implies some greater level of sadism than is present in most opportunistic killings. An examination of this victim's genitals also showed signs of rape, both vaginally and anally. She had also been killed with a gunshot to the head, but wounds on her torso also looked to show signs of stabbing. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, on January 28th, these doctors moved on to the body of the third victim, Miriam Garcia Ibora. Like Desiree, Miriam was also found without socks. I cannot tell you whether this was a simple oversight or a more malicious sign of them being stolen. However, a more ominous missing part of the puzzle was the right hand of Miriam, which investigators never recovered. And unlike the other victims, she had likely suffered some sort of beating at the hands of her captor, as she was missing multiple teeth. Like the second body examined, she also showed signs of various rapes. But shockingly, her genitals showed signs of various rips and tears produced after her death. Again, this was the end result of a sick, violent person. Or persons. While Miguel Ricart toiled away in a prison cell on the day of January 28th, the media stormed not only La Romana, where the bodies of the three girls had been found, but Alcácer, their hometown as well. The night that the bodies were found, the families of the victims met at Alcácer Town Hall, where investigators and police officials met with them and confirmed that the bodies were of the three girls. Mere hours later, almost every regional news network was tuned into the crime, trying to get the thoughts and opinions of the family members involved. For most of us, this is almost expected when it comes to a highly publicized missing persons case, especially when those missing persons are three teenage girls. But for Spain, and the country at large, they look back at this media takeover as an embarrassment, akin to the O.J. Simpson or Casey Anthony media frenzy we saw here in the United States, where serious journalists began to succumb to sensationalizing every minute detail or random gossip. Over the following weeks and months, the media would be there to broadcast every small detail, no matter how gruesome or obscene. They were there to ask the family members of Miriam, Desiree, and Tony how they felt to have had a murdered daughter. They'd ask their family and friends how they felt to know the gory details of their teenage loved one's murder, how two girls were decapitated, and one had her nipple ripped off with pliers. How two had their hands bound, but the other was missing a hand, so the police can only guess that she was as well. I only say this because I'm not joking. Almost any article you read about the case refers to this incident, the murder of the three Alcácer girls, as the tipping point in Spanish media. Instead of searching for the truth, the media smelled blood in the water, and they flocked to it like sharks. They wanted to make their coverage as shocking as possible, and followed up with anyone willing to speak to them. Is it by any surprise that as the area began to find out the horrifying details of how these three teenage girls had met their grisly fate, that they were ready to string up any poor sap presented in front of them? Unlucky for Miguel Ricart, he was that sap. Over the next day, the area was alight. The Alcácer girls had been found, and a suspect already arrested. Unfortunately, police had little to no evidence to feasibly connect their only suspect to the crime. He simply happened to have a car similar to the one seen nearby where the girls disappeared, and a paper with the name of someone he knew was found nearby the crime scene. Thanks to the ineptitude of the early investigators who canvassed the scene, we have no idea where the document with Enrique Anglés' name came from, only that it was not found in the pit that the girls' bodies were found in. So, police focused in on the man that they had in custody, Miguel Ricart, a convicted felon and general deadbeat. His first conversation with police had been fruitless. He had generated a bunch of potential for police, based off of his relationship with Antonio Inglis and his white Opel Corso, but his answers had been nothing, really. He provided nothing, and believed to be going home soon. But after his arrest, at 5:40 in the morning, the next 20 or so hours are pretty much all guesswork. We have no idea what conditions Miguel Ricart was being held in, who he was speaking to, etc. It was the next day, January 28th, that Miguel Ricart confessed to having involvement in the crimes. Mind you, this confession took place at nearly midnight, almost an entire day after originally being detained. For all we know, Miguel wasn't allowed to eat or sleep during this time period. In this confession, which Miguel signed off on afterwards, Miguel gives the investigators a rough timeline of how he and Antonio Inglis had abducted the girls. Allegedly. Miguel's first confession begins by saying that him and Antonio had taken the three girls at an unspecified time, and that the girls went along willingly. Apparently, they had used another vehicle, a Blue Seat Ronda, a Spanish vehicle brand very similar to old Honda Civics. This stands at a clear contrast with the car used by the alleged kidnappers, which was a white sedan. Miguel states that Antonio and he had driven the three girls out to La Romana. Apparently, the girls did not voice any real concern or fight back. Then again, this confession doesn't make a lot of sense. Apparently, when they got to the desolate part of La Romana, Miguel's confession alleges that he had a sexual interaction with 14-year-old Desiree, while Antonio went off into the night with the other two, 14-year-old Miriam and 15-year-old Tony. Mind you, at this point in the confession, everything is consensual between the girls and the two older men. I understand that the girls were minors, I'm just stating that this confession reads as odd because Miguel doesn't talk about any of the girls fighting back. He basically says that he and Desiree were having sex, not that he was raping her against her will. Then, Miguel states that approximately 20 minutes passed before he heard three gunshots in the distance. At this point, things get very murky. He never really states what happened to Desiree at that point, whether he killed her, or she went off to look for her friends, or Antonio came back from the distance to kill her. He just says that he was a distance away from the four of them when the three girls were killed. Then, with the three girls now dead, the two men apparently drove to a house nearby to pick up a rug, which they used to wrap up the three girls in a freshly dug pit. Oh yeah, and apparently they managed to dig the pit, which was in midwinter and without a shovel, in the darkness of night. Then they placed the bodies of the three girls, now wrapped in the rug, in the pit. This is only the first confession, but it would prove a tricky one for police and prosecutors to try and prove. And, just fortunately enough for them, Miguel's confessions would continue to change depending on the evidence that the police and prosecutors had on hand. Miguel would later claim that this confession, which was taken over 24 hours after he was first detained, and which completely contradicts his original statement, was coerced through torture and abuse at the hands of the Spanish Civil Guard. At this point, police had just a few things tying them to a group of suspects. First, they had the evidence that had pointed them to the direction of these suspects in the first place. This was the hospital flyer from the year beforehand, with the name of Enrique Inglis. Enrique was the brother of Antonio, and was now sitting in a neighboring holding cell of Miguel Ricart. Second, they had the confession of Miguel Ricart. He would claim years later that this confession was coerced, and that the only part to come of it that was from him was his signature at the very end. Lastly, there was an association between these two to a man named Antonio Inglis. Antonio, as we all know by now, was a legitimately bad guy with a history of violence. But the police had a couple of major issues on their hands, namely that Antonio Inglis had not officially been seen in about a year. Also, I haven't seen this one mentioned on a lot of websites or sources about the case, but many of Antonio's friends and family told investigators that he was gay. This just meant that police would try and frame their narrative in a different way. Instead of stating that Antonio had committed these crimes for pleasure, he had done it because he hated women. Of course, you'd think that this matter could be settled by simply finding Antonio and bringing him in to check and see whether his story matched up with Miguel Ricart's. Unfortunately, Antonio Anglès would never be found. He has not been seen in almost 30 years. His story I'll discuss further in part 3 of The Alcácer Girls.